And we're going to start with an overview of the Department of Agriculture, and Chuck is going to come and address us. Okay? Come on up, Chuck. It's been a long time since I've seen you, at least 36 hours.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. When we spoke the other evening, you asked me to come and kind of give a thumbnail sketch of the department and our legislative program for this session. So I gave each of you a packet, and don't mean just to load you down with paper, but there's a lot of information about agriculture and the department in here, and so I'll just point out what these things are. I'm going to talk to you mainly on the department through the biennial report, which is in the most recent issue of the Ag Quarterly, which is in draft form right now, because as you know, we've had some changes very recently, and so this is still subject to some last-minute revision. But we have a couple things in here. One, this Oregon Farmer's Handbook is a compilation of all the regulations that agriculture has to deal with. There's also an Oregon Ag Resources Directory in here, which tells you how to get a hold of just about any ag organization or service agency that you can think of. Little pamphlet on facts and figures of interest about Oregon agriculture, and then there's a copy of the latest edition of the Ag and Fisheries Statistics that we put out jointly with the Oregon Ag Statistics Service. So, Mr. Chair, to begin with a description of the Department of Agriculture was created back in the 30s by consolidating a bunch of small boards and commissions together that had to do with agriculture. Today, it's a medium-sized agency in terms of what other state agencies are like. We have about 700 employees. That translates into about 425 FTE because a number of the employees are seasonal. We have a total budget of somewhat more than $80 million. About a third of that is lottery and general fund. About 60% is other funds, primarily license fees and permit fees. And then the remaining 6 or 7% is federal funds. So we're not as nearly heavily general funded as we were several years ago. We administer about 30 chapters of Oregon law, I guess I would just make the comment that I think that the Department of Agriculture is about as diverse as Oregon agriculture itself. We are one of the more diverse agricultural states, producing something like 250 separate commodities. So specialization and diversity is one of the characteristics that you would use to describe Oregon ag. If you look at in this Ag Quarterly, on page 6, there's an organizational chart for the department, and it describes our mission and also shows that we're organized around that mission. We have a threefold mission one element is to ensure food safety and provide consumer protection. We also protect agricultural natural resources, and we promote economic development in the agriculture industry. If you look at this chart, the way we're organized, it's largely around those three mission areas. On the left are primarily the natural resource functions of the agency. In addition, the administrative service division happens to be in that cluster right now. But we have the plant division, the natural resources division, and the animal health and identification division. And we do a really wide variety of things there, from protecting Oregon agriculture and natural resources from serious pests and invasive organisms like weeds and dangerous livestock diseases, to running water quality programs and deterring theft of livestock. In the food safety area, we license and inspect all of the food handling facilities in the state, with the exception of retail food service outlets, which the health division takes care of. We regulate pesticides for the safe use of pesticides. We license and certify every device that's used commercially in the state in commerce for measuring. And then we also perform independent third-party grading function for agricultural commodities. Then in the marketing area, we have a whole division of our department whose responsibilities is to expand markets and to try to create or develop new value-added opportunities for agricultural business. And we also have a laboratory complex connected with that that's able to certify Oregon products for export and perform a variety of analytical services for folks that are producing a new product. So that's a pretty quick overview of what we do and the way we're structured. I think what I would mention at this point before I go into our legislative program is I think we have three very pressing concerns right now. I mean, we could have a very long list, but the three that are at the top of the challenges that we think are really significant for the immediate future are, one, finding ways to continue to provide the services that we do in the face of declining revenues. That's certainly a challenge, and we're going to have to find new ways to do things. Secondly, obviously, we have to strengthen our efforts to expand markets for value-added food and agricultural products. We need to put a real emphasis on that. And then finally, I think one thing, as you're aware of, we have a pesticide use reporting program that involves having a law on the books that's going to require pesticide users to report their use of pesticides. And the development of that system has been, shall we say, suspended. And we need to get resolution of that if we can this session, because the department is in a position of not being able to comply with the law, and so are pesticide users, because the system that's there can't do what the law requires to be done. So that's one issue that we'd like to see taken care of. Then you have a page that has our department bills that were pre-session filed listed on it. And we have, in comparison with past years, a really slim legislative program this year. We only have four of our own bills. Senate Bill 241 would make our authority for assessing civil penalties against people who violate quarantines, nursery and Christmas tree licensing laws, and imported timber health regulations, would make that authority permanent. That authority was granted to us by the legislature two sessions ago, with a sunset on it. We had some crises in our nursery program the first biennium after that, and we didn't get things implemented. We came back and asked it to be extended, and we did then put the rules in place and get the program up and running. We think it's been pretty useful, so we're asking for that to be made permanent.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir. Senator Corcoran.
I realize that we'll be probably discussing this when we come to the bill substantively, but could you just very briefly, Chuck, tell us why there was a sunset put on it in the first place?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, I think for the most part it was because the affected industry wanted to see how it worked out.
And? How did it work out?
And I think it's worked out fine. Now, what I think I should add that I believe that I have not heard a final position from the nursery industry on this. The primary affected industries are the nursery industry and the Christmas tree industry, waiting to hear from the legislative committee of the nurserymen. But I think the Christmas tree folks are supportive of an extension. I don't know that they necessarily want to go for it being made permanent right now. But
we have the Christmas tree industry to my right here, so we'll find out, won't we?
In fact, I had expected Senator Beyer would have a question before Senator Corcoran did on the issue, but why don't we let you finish your report and then we'll have all the questions, because I know there's some coming. Okay?
Sure. Okay. Also, a very important element of our plans to expand some of our marketing activity, we're seeking legislative authority to conduct what are called identity preserved programs. And that is what that encompasses is inspecting and certifying whole processes of producing an agricultural product so that you can have validation of a product in a market that tells people that this is what I'm buying, is what I associate this product with, and it tends to create value added for the product. And we have a program called the Oregon Advantage that we're developing that's seeking to embody the good things about Oregon products in a program like this, so that in a market like Japan, that when they see Oregon beef or Oregon wine or other products from Oregon, they know that it is from Oregon. They know that it was produced according to a process that's been certified and validated, and they associate the characteristics of that product with the good things that they know about Oregon products. And I think this is a very essential thing for us to do. Some buying entities are starting to insist upon certification like this in making their buying decision. And this is a voluntary program that would be funded by fees that for service, essentially. We have had the authority to establish grades and standards for agricultural products for a long time, but this involves going from all the way from seed to finished processed product, and we need to clearly have the authority to do that. House Bill 2194 is strictly a housekeeping measure that would change the billing period for our services from 15 days in statute to 30, and change some nomenclature in the law to make it consistent with current accounting usage. Then House Bill 2254 is a fee increase bill for our livestock brand program. And the last fee increase we had in this program was in 91. Since then, costs have, due to inflation, have basically risen somewhere in the approximately 50% range. And the program has operated off of a declining balance for some time. We're reaching the point where we're going to have to raise the fees to maintain the services that we provide there. The proposal here actually deals mostly with the brand renewal fee it increases it and also extends the period that it's applicable for. This proposal has been worked out carefully with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, which is the primary affected entity here. So, Mr. Chair, I might just mention a number of other bills that I know are out there in a developmental stage that will be coming your way. I don't know that they're well enough developed in detail that I should try to say too much about them, but certainly one that's very critical to Oregon agriculture is that there's a bill that would eliminate the exemption of agricultural labor from collective bargaining laws, and the Farm Bureau and the Oregon Nurserymen's Association is developing. There is a bill that would resolve some of the constitutional questions related to commodity commissions, which is also a very significant bill. There's also a bill that would try to augment resources available for noxious weed control that is going to be brought forward by a very broad consensus group of stakeholders. And so I think with that I would stop with my prepared presentation and ask if you have questions of me.
Chair, you're looking at me.
Yeah.
I was kind of looking at you.
You have some questions, Senator.
I have to start with the obvious one. Under your salmon cover sheet you gave us, Oregon's top 40 commodities, horses and mules, number 20. For what purpose? I don't think they're meat animals, are they?
You know, Mr. Chairman, I have never looked at that, but my guess would be this may be connected with the racing industry. Mules, you know, it's probably a broad category of horses and mules. I don't know how many mules are produced, but I know there are a number of horse breeders that breed quarter horses and thoroughbreds and so on in the state, and that very well may be what this reflects.
Okay. Seriously, I get Bill 241. I attended a Christmas tree growers legislative meeting last week, and you said they are not supporting removing the sunset. That is correct. They would support extending the sunset for another 2 years, and I haven't heard from the nurserymen, but I'm assuming that probably would be about the same way, and primarily the response was that it took 2 years after we passed the law originally to grant it to even write the rules to start it, and since then it's been used, well, it hasn't been used at all with the exception of 6 letters written, so either there is not a problem and there's no one violating the law, or you're not using the authority you've got, one of the two or somewhere, and I guess that was the response I heard from the Christmas tree.
Mm-hmm.
And that I haven't heard from anybody. Okay. That you haven't. Yeah. Either. So,
yeah. Mr. Chair, would you like me to follow on to that? You're absolutely correct, Senator Beyer, that we have not assessed any civil penalties. Formally, we have notified people 6 times that if they don't do what they have to do, that we're going to initiate enforcement proceedings, and that warning has worked in all of those times. So I consider that a success. We did not ask for this authority to be able to go out and hammer people for large penalties. We wanted the authority to be able to get people to comply with the law. And so there actually have been a number of other people that have been reluctant to get licensed or whatever, who we've been able to persuade that it's not worth it. You know, it's going to cost you as much not to get a license as it does to get a license. So, you know, please cooperate with us. This is the reason that we do this, and it has worked. I think it's you know, it's reduced the problem we were faced with originally that was bothering us, that there were a number of people who just were ignoring us and refusing to get a license, and they were, some of them were relatively prominent, and they were creating criticism from other people who were licensed. Why aren't we doing something about that? And the prospect really was to go to court and press criminal charges for a license fee of $75. What really wasn't a very workable thing. I think that two things. One, you know, we're now engaged with the Christmas tree industry, and we will soon with the nursery industry, in what they perceive some of the more involved enforcement-related problems are that are harder to detect than just a highly visible business not being licensed, but what kinds of things are going on behind the scenes that they feel endanger the industry. And our hope is to be able to develop a program that with them that will address that. But we've been quite cautious and reserved in first developing the rules and then applying them in a way that people would feel that we're going to be reasonable and that this isn't going to come back to haunt them. Also, in the area of quarantines, we recently had a case where a person who has trees infected with sudden oak death was refusing to comply with the quarantine requirements. And I think that as more and more invasive sorts of species are knocking at our door, and we bump up against having to have a tool to get people to cooperate with us relatively quickly, this authority will be important in that area. And so that's the other thing that I would offer up, is that in the long term, I think it's important to have it for those kinds of reasons too, even though we have not done a lot of fines and made a big splash with it. We didn't really intend to do that. That wasn't why we wanted the authority. So I'm sure we'll have more discussion about this. But
I realize I'm addressing a question to Senator Beyer, as you, but you know, Senator and I talked about this the other day. He mentioned, you know, those six incidents where you've written letters, and I'm wondering if Chuck's response got to the other half of your thing. You said driving home that you could practically find six people in violation just on the way home or something. Do you think they should be doing more enforcement than they are? Or what? I'm just trying to get all the cards laid out on the table here.
Well, the department is in a catch-22 somewhat, because if they go out and start assessing civil penalties willy-nilly, the industry will probably come back and say, "We see, we told you to use this as a hand. That's why we didn't want to give them place." If they don't do anything, which they, you know, they really haven't used it much, the industry is going to say, "Well, you see, they don't need it," just like we said all along. But at the same time, I think the frustration from the Christmas tree industry is there are still prominent producers out there. People know who they are, and they have never been notified, never been contacted.
Prominent producers that are not in compliance?
Not in compliance. And they want, I guess the big question is, why have they not been caught?
Would you like to take a stab at the big question?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know the details of that. I have talked to some of the Christmas tree growers, and I've also had some, and our staff in the Christmas tree program, I've also had some experiences in other programs. I can remember when Phil and I were called over to Tillamook one day to a board of directors meeting at the Tillamook Creamery, and the board said, "There are a number of people here that are not in compliance with their CAFO permit. We want you to do something about this soon. And we said, great. Give us a list. We'll be right there. We can't do that. So that's part of it. We need to be working with the industry organization to find out what their perception of the problem is and how we would go about this with a program that would, you know, be seen as acceptable by the industry and not a witch hunt or not an overbearing enforcement sort of program, but would be doing what it's intended to do, to protect the industry without getting in everybody's face that's, you know, trying to make a living. And so that's the balance we need to strike, and that's where we're trying to go.
And that's why the industry, the meeting I attended, decided that they're not staying in the sunset out another 2 years. We can't come to some agreement. There's a recognition that it's frustrating for the industry that the only time this ever gets mentioned is when the sunset comes up.
Right.
If the sunset were not here, this would never be an issue of discussion again, as it's here. And this brings the department and the industry back together at the advisory board level and at the industry level so that people can, it just forces an automatic review of the agency and what they've done with their authority. And that's why they want to keep the sunset in place, just extend it out again, because they know then that the department will report and we can, there's a check and balance.
Mr. Chairman, we're okay with that until we get the program well enough established that everybody's comfortable with it. So,
and this will be an interesting discussion when we get to it. I can see. Are there other questions that any of you have? Okay, thank you, Chuck. Appreciate your coming and sharing with us this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, it's Ted's turn. You want to come up, and Ted's going to give an overview of the forest
department. In the gym. Yeah. Even there's vegetarian mules.
Oh, yeah.
Tofu mules, I think is what they call them. Yeah.
The spam lamb.
Try to ignore the senators to my left and just begin your report.
Chair Shields and members of the Senate Ag and Natural Resource Committee, my name is Ted Lawrence. I'm Assistant State Forester with the Oregon Department of Forestry. I guess I have been called a mule on occasion, so I can certainly relate to the need for a commodity commission to at least address us folks in a positive way.
Yeah, otherwise donkeys slip through, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you really
got to
watch this stuff, you know.
Some people have accused me of being kicked in the head by a mule as well. So,
he's Irish.
I know you're all pretty familiar with the Oregon Department of Forestry and our programs. Did want to raise some just organizational issues. As you know, State Forester Jim Brown, after 16 and a half years of being state forester, has moved to the governor's office, and the Oregon Board of Forestry will be pursuing a process to fill that position, and they'll be meeting Monday to approve that process. Certainly from the Department of Forestry's perspective, Jim Brown will be very sorely missed and somebody that we very much appreciated having as state forester. Also, from a matter of principle, the department has a number of programs, the state forest program self-supported, but the remainder of the programs, forest practices, fire, forestry assistance, are all supported in a balance between public and landowner contributions. And we think that principle is an important principle, and we hope that in providing services over the course of this legislative session, that principle can be maintained. I've attached a one-page summary of our 9 bills. Majority of those bills relate to the fire program, 5.5 of them. One of the bills is our biennial harvest tax setting bill that we're required to introduce every session. Another bill deals with family forest land taxation that would establish an alternative tax program to the current program that basically requires that landowners pay based upon value of the property as opposed to a mix of timber and property values. And for the small landowners, which have a different revenue flow than larger landowners, being able to pay the bulk of their property tax at the time of harvest is a valuable option that they would like to keep, and they're working through that process in a bill that we brought forward. The bulk of the remaining bills are fire bills. As you know, the 2002 fire season was an extraordinary fire season. It's important to put some context on that because it hasn't just been the only extraordinary fire season lately. West-wide, we've had a series of bad fire seasons, and Oregon has had severe fire seasons fairly frequently the last several years. But 2002 was remarkable. For all federal and state protected lands, over 1 million acres burned. About 200,000 acres of that was rangeland, and the remaining was forest lands. About 800,000 acres out of the 27.5 million acres of forest burned in Oregon last year, which is quite remarkable. Many million dollars were expended. We had 10,000 firefighters involved at one time. Over three-quarters of the department's workforce was engaged in fire suppression activities at one time in the summer, which is quite remarkable. The Biscuit Fire that got a lot of attention in southern Oregon area is now the single most expensive fire on record at over $150 million in federal funds. That's a lot of money. Certainly the state also expended a lot of funds. This is the policy of Oregon to provide a complete and coordinated fire protection system. And we do that by providing a lot of cooperation with a number of players, including private partners, landowners, operators, fire contractors. And Oregon's somewhat unique in that arena with fire contractors. We have more resources on contract in terms of crews than any other state by a big margin. Federal partners and then a range of state agency partners, including the Department of Corrections, National Guard, and State Fire Marshal and Office of Emergency Management. And I would certainly want to acknowledge the role that those other state agencies played in this past fire season. It was very, very important to our success on our particular actions. This system's tied together with a bunch of agreements. The local level of mutual aid, closest forces at the broader scale, there's a number of compacts and contracts. And those agreements really spell out how we work together to provide both initial attack as well as extended attack. It's fair to say that during the course of the fire season, a number of issues were identified that we need to address to make the system work better. The majority of those issues were federal fire management issues in terms of how the federal agencies manage the fires and work with the department. And I've attached, which is your third attachment on the back, page of matrices that really lay out some of these fire management issues that we're working with the federal agencies on. And the particular issues on the left-hand side and our recommendation to the federal agencies on the right-hand side. And most of them are operational. There are some key policy issues that aren't addressed in here. But I would say that we're working at both the regional, local, and national level to address these issues. And we think that we're making progress. These issues had a big impact on our operations and costs, and by addressing them in an effective way, we certainly can improve the system quite a bit. I think those issues are certainly informative to you, I hope. Those issues have been shared at the national level with the Forest Service and are getting attention at that level, and we appreciate their effort to do that. The second major fire issue deals with the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund, which is the state's insurance fund, so to speak, to provide for emergency fire cost protection. And there's a bill that we've submitted that would increase the reserve base and also provide a different means of paying for the increased cost of insurance. Oregon is really unique, and we're the only place in the world that actually has an insurance premium for emergency fire suppression. And there's always winners and losers in insurance. In the last several years, the insurance providers have been big-time losers. And so there's a basic question of, can we get insurance? Assuming we can, we know that those premiums will probably be greater than what they've been in the past, and we may well have to create a different arrangement in terms of how we'd share the burden for additional costs. I've attached a letter that we provided to Speaker of the House Mark Simmons in December that describes the issues surrounding the fund and the different options that we're pursuing in terms of the insurance, and it also gets to the detail in terms of some of the issues with the reserve base and increased cost of insurance premium. The second issue with regard to the State's Protection Fire Program that's fairly key in terms of our experience this past season as well as other seasons are unprotected lands. And those are lands that lie outside of a forest protection district that don't have any other form of rural or other association fire protection. And when fires start on those lands, they can sometimes threaten protected lands. And what we're proposing is that we make it clear when the state forester can take action on those fires that might threaten forest lands, so we can make sure that we do it in an appropriate way in an appropriate time, and also that it does establish some level of responsibility to the landowners to take appropriate action. And if appropriate action wasn't taken, then there would be some avenue for some cost recovery. There's fairly limited ability to do that, but that's the basic notion. So those are the two key fire issues. In terms of other issues that I think are important that are likely to come to your attention, there's a lawsuit that's directed at the state forester called Pacific Rivers Council et al. Versus the state forester. In fact, there's an article in the Oregonian about that case today. Several associations basically have brought suit where they're claiming the state forester has violated the Endangered Species Act by causing take of listed coho salmon. The suit alleges basically through the approval of the state forester of certain types of operations, the state forester is then responsible for any take that might occur for those types of operations. The state entered a motion to dismiss the suit on a number of grounds. The federal court denied that motion, which in effect does authorize lawsuits for take under those circumstances of approving written plans. The plaintiffs have also requested a preliminary injunction, which would address those operations on high-risk sites where landslides may occur. And that particular issue is being considered by the judge in early February. The injunction, if granted, would cause a number of impacts, both the landowners as well as the state, in terms of imposing costs on us for administering whatever the injunction may require. And it's speculative to some degree on what the injunction may actually say, but the way the system's set up is there are a very few limited number of approvals the state forester grants. Basically, the Forest Practices Program is a notification system, but there are a few approvals. One of them is prior approval on high-risk sites. The only basis in statute for not giving approval is that the plan or the action would not comply with the Forest Practices Act. Anything the state forester denies is appealable to the board, so it creates a conundrum, basically. If there's an injunction that says the state forester can't approve these things, even though they would comply with state law, the Board of Forestry would then be faced with having to address any appeals, and we're not sure how that would work out. So there's both an implication in terms of cost for landowners and some real implications in terms of process and cost for the state. Basically, the key policy in terms of the legal arguments is that basically state and local government programs that have some form of approval may well then have some form of liability, and it raises some fundamental questions about the state's regulatory system. Because these implications are so large, we are sharing the cost on this case with other state agencies. They've agreed to support us on terms of the Department of Justice costs. So that's a pretty big issue. The Board of Forestry will be hearing some proposals for amending rules on Monday, which would change the relationship in terms of the causal mechanism of prior approval, and we hope that will help address some of the issues. Finally, there's the issue of state forest management. There's likely to be some legislative proposals directing how those state forests might be managed. The department has developed a really innovative approach for managing those forests in terms of creating a diverse array of forest stand types through active management. Those conditions would provide a range of habitats over time and space while also producing timber and revenues. This approach is called structure-based management. You'll probably hear that in the future. But basically, on both sides of the debate, there's folks calling for more harvest and less harvest, and you're likely to hear that debate, and I think it's a worthy debate, and we will hope to provide you good information as that comes up to you. So I hope this information is helpful to you. Be happy to answer any questions.
Roger. Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. Your House Bill 2202, Unprotected Lands, back in 97 session, we had an issue, Senate Bill 350, 390, something like that. How is this different? I mean, I'm sure you recall that too, Chad.
Chair Shields and Senator Beyer, actually there's been several efforts at the unprotected lands issue over sessions. This is quite a bit different in terms of scaling down responsibility in terms of both the expectations for when landowners would have to do something. It doesn't obligate them to necessarily abate a nuisance or take control action or form districts, but it does set some level of responsibility. So it's a scaled down version, and we hope and we're still working with landowner interest to negotiate on it, so we're not hoping to bring this forward to debate until we get some better sense of how people are going to feel about it. But It's a touchy issue. The lands in question are relatively low value in terms of being able to generate revenue, so the landowners are faced with a conundrum of they can't really afford to provide fire protection for themselves. On the other hand, when the fire does occur, it creates a conundrum from the state in terms of having to take action and costs. And if we can create a shared responsibility and partnership, I think that would be a positive solution to this.
Yes. Thank you. I'm curious, just your catch line here in your handout says state forests could take action on unprotected lands and recovered costs. How do federal lands fall into that, specifically in that area? I mean, because that's one of the worst offenders as far as they don't take any action on when a fire starts and it burns out into somewhere else. The Silver Fire, and that was a prime example of that this last year.
Chair Shields and Senator Beyer, that's a really good question, and let's see how I put it. We agree with your observation that the state has an interest in making sure that the Forest Service and other federal agencies take more aggressive actions when their failure to do so would threaten private lands and other resource values. We are asking the Department of Justice to look at that question of whether or not we would have authority if, in our opinion, this is State Forest's opinion, that the Forest Service or other federal agencies are not taking appropriate action for us to step in and do that and recover our costs. Legal question from a fundamental policy standpoint, we do believe that the federal agencies need to understand that their inability or reluctance to take aggressive action has resulted in loss to private lands, which then can certainly impact a number of outcomes in terms of revenue and the landowner's interests.
I just want to amplify the question a little bit. You said inability or inaction. Which is it? different situations?
Chair Shields, we have a positive partnership with the Forest Service, and there's lots of great people that are trying to do a good job on the federal lands. They've got a confusing array of policies and constraints, and I'm not sure they have a full understanding of their policies through their system at this point in time. And so I think there's some inability in that context. And they certainly also had a reduction in forces as well. Well, that's been ameliorated the last several years, so they've actually improved their level of protection. But they did have a reduction in forces over the past decade or what was in place before. So I think it's a mix of policy issues and resource issues and management issues. And that matrix lays out a number of those things. But it's fair to say that on some cases, the Forest Service fire management teams felt that they did not have an obligation to take action in the context of the state's interest, and it caused some real problems.
I'd just like to say good luck. I'm glad that's a House bill, 2202. As you probably remember, I served on the Forest Department Task Force in 95 and 96 when we came up with the last attempt at unprotected lands, and I was caught in the middle of that eruption, I guess, what happened when that bill got presented to the legislature.
Senator Shields and Senator Beyer, we understand the difficulty and sensitivity on this particular issue, and had them planned to include you in the group hug when we do get something that'll work. It was a problem this past fire season where there was clearly expectations of people that did not have protection then trying to impose service or request on the state, and then getting mad when there was fairly limited ability to do that. And it's got to be a partnership that we create, and hopefully we'll be able to solve that problem.
I've been listening to you sharing, and I want to commend you for your diplomacy as you speak.
The last guy got punished and had to go work for the governor.
That's
no figure.
Yeah, well, I guess that's part of the diplomacy, huh? While these three guys live out in the woods and, you know all the answers to all the questions before they ask them, or before
the nearest neighbor.
Could you maybe? I don't know whether to ask my question or just listen to the sidebars over here. I mean, you know, they're always so fascinating. I'll be the first to say that I'm somewhat behind these guys in understanding and asking specific questions. But when I was in Chiloquin in the 70s, some of my running buddies and really close friends were U.S. Forest Service personnel on the Wainingham National Forest, and their compound was about a half a mile from where I lived. So I spent a lot of time with them. I even went to fire guard camp and stuff like that with them. You were talking about reductions in forces and all the things that have happened. If I were to go back and spend as much time there 20 years later, 25 years later, what are the differences that I would see in the way? Because I didn't know the master plans, but I was out walking in the forest. I was with guys who lived it day in and day out. So I had a feel for what was going on. What differences would I see today as opposed to the late 70s when I was out there wandering around all the time?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, that's a really good question. Certainly the Forest Service is a diverse group now, and always has been. But so it's hard to generalize. But I'll give you my opinion on this. The cultures change in terms of I think the connection to the land. I would say there's probably fewer of the fire horses, timber beasts, and more folks that are in resource management for other perspectives in terms of fish, wildlife, and that sort of thing. So it's a cultural shift. On a technical basis, they've lost a lot of their expertise. So, I mean, on the fire management end, they just basically, a lot of their fire expertise is retired and left. And with the reduction in forces, they were not able to maintain that expertise. And that also, I think it's fair to say, in the timber side as well, they just lost their expertise. And when they've tried to put up timber sales in a timely way, they just not have the resources and expertise to do it. I think they've also probably have a less clear mission. I mean, and a part of what we see in the fire business is the Department of Forestry still has a very clear mission, and to put out the fires. And we do have the understanding that you've also got to address other forest health issues in that context, but there's other ways of doing that other than through wildfire. And so our mission is very clear. We go to put out fires and do it in a cost-effective way. The Forest Service's mission with regard to fire is pretty squishy right now. And so it's not necessarily to put out the fire. It's to manage fire and to achieve, in some cases, other purposes. And my experience in fire is fairly clear that fire management is an art and a science. And you can use fire in any number of ways, but if you try and manage fire, you're going to have some major failures over time, and you got to be willing to accept that. But I think just the squishiness of their mission makes it much more difficult for them to accomplish their goals, because it's just not very well defined at this point in time. Level experience is a lot less than what it was probably 20 years ago. But I am, I guess, at the national level, the head of aviation fire management, Jerry Williams, is a old smoke jumper and understands our concerns and supports many of them. And for, as an example, we fight fire at night. And it's an optimal time to do it. Temperatures are...
Find it.
Well, you could find fire at night. There are some safety issues, but you can do it safely. And actually, in many ways, it is more safe because the temperatures are down, humidities are up, and you can work direct to the fire. You can make great progress at night. The Forest Service does not generally fight fire at night. And because of the very strong concerns about safety, but I would put our safety record up against theirs, and we do it very, very well. So it's a...
Excuse me, have you done that? Have you got a comparison that's available that people can...
Yeah, we've talked about that with them, and actually it's one of the ironies in terms of looking at fire management and risk is most of the injuries and accidents that occur really are from extension of risk over time and space. Most of the fire incidents in terms of injuries is past season or vehicle accidents. If you fight fire for 30 days, you're going to have vehicle accidents at a higher rate than if you do it for 3 days. If you're out there fighting fire for 30 days, there are likely to be some snags that are going to fall down and hurt somebody. If you do it for 3 days, there's fewer snags. So it's a risk management issue. Firefighting is a risky business, but you got to balance those risks. And in fairness to the Forest Service, they had some fatalities up in Washington several years back. And they're trying to work through that, and I'm not sure they've successfully communicated their message. That's caused some real problems. But we've been very, very safe in our efforts.
I could ask a few more questions, because it's a fascinating area, and what you're describing. I mean, you can put some dollar signs to a lot of this stuff, and I guess that would lead to a question that I'll stop and save further questions till some other time. But can you, given your management of state forests, give us a kind of a relationship to how the feds are in terms of costs? I mean,
Senator Shields, members of the committee, I've got an excellent example. We were actually out on the ground on a tour with the regional director of NIMS, Bob Lahn, looking at some Oregon plan improvements on forest land. And we were actually looking at a culvert installment on Weyerhaeuser land that was actually done by the Willamette Industries prior to Weyerhaeuser's purchase of Willamette. It was done to improve fish passage, a large arch pipe. And we had the Forest Service acting deputy director with us, a regional deputy director, who's also had been the regional engineer. And Weyerhaeuser said it cost them $13,000 to put in that pipe. And he was really impressed with that. And his comment was, it would cost us $170,000 just to go through the process of getting to approval and putting in the pipe. And he looked at me and said, what would it cost the state to put in that pipe on state forest land? I said, $13,000. So that's the magnitude difference. And I'd say that magnitude of difference exists on firefighting as well.
That's okay. You just opened the door even wider than I thought it would be open. Because, I mean, you're pointing at things I didn't think about. What I was driving at was, if you're managing it better, your fire suppression costs are less. You have pretty good documentation on that compared with what the federal forests look like.
Senator Shields, correct.
Are you running for Congress or something?
No.
Just checking.
I'm just trying to keep you awake, Senator Corcoran. That's all I'm doing.
Failing miserably.
Well, what end is this going to be? Never mind. I'll stop there. I don't think I should go any longer. I could be in trouble.
Great. Happy to answer any questions.
Well, you certainly have always given me a lot to think about whenever we've had a chance to talk, and I appreciate it. And I'm sure we'll see you back here.
Great.
From time to time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your time. I want to make a comment that I've been making lately, and that is to announce that anybody, any interest group or any organization that wants to respond to any of these reports that you've heard, I'm going to have a special hearing on the 31st of January. If you want to call Judith, you can call Judith. 986-1688 is her phone. Get on the list. I've been thinking about this for a while, and if in fact there's more people than could be handled in one morning's testimony, we'll go to two, because I want to hear all sides of these various issues. Also, you can make a pitch with Judith, and she can get back to me, or you can talk to me directly. If you have some idea of how much time you need, speak to her about that. I might even think about this, and I haven't talked to Judith about the complexity of it, but those that sign up first, we might even have a list published a few days ahead of time so you know when who's coming in, and if we had that out there and posted, people would not have to come in here and sit for 2 hours to talk for 10 minutes or whatever, because they'll know when they're going to be on the agenda, and I'm going to try to stick to that agenda. We'll set the time of the meeting depending on how many people have signed up. If it's few, why, we'll start at 8:30. If there's more, we'll start at 8, and so on. Anyway.
Some lieu of hearing bills and stuff.
this is the city boy trying to catch up with the country cousins. Anything else?
No, this is too much fun.
I see. Too much fun. I can tell he's excited this morning. You ought to see him in the Senate.
My heart soars like an eagle.
Yeah. Well, that beats turkey buzzards, doesn't it?
Yes.
With that, we're adjourned.